measurement, input circuit, output circuit, transfer characteristics, whatever, of your circuit. And if you deviate a whole lot from 50 ohms, if you go down to, let me pick a number, a tenth of an ohm, it can handle that. If you go on the other direction, from 50 ohms up to maybe 50,000 ohms, 5,000 ohms, yes, it can handle that. When you start getting an impedance on one of the ports of your device under test of numbers like 1 million ohms, now the display on the screen, if it was a Smith chart, goes way out to the perimeter, and you would not necessarily be able to resolve the difference between 1 million ohms and 2 million ohms. A 2-to-1 ratio, you might not be able to resolve it. Whereas if you're making a measurement near 50 ohms, and you want to know, is it 50 or is it 50.001 ohms, the machine will display that to you. So it has very high resolution near 50 ohms. If you go very, very close to 0 ohms, it starts losing resolution. If you start going very high toward 1 million ohms, we'll say, it starts losing resolution. You can still get a measurement, but the measurement will have higher and higher error because the machine was not designed for that kind of measurement. Let me drop. On top of that, in the case of a Tesla coil, the leakage reactance, in other words, between the primary winding and the secondary winding, if I was winding a power transformer that ran from Con Ed to Loco or whatever, the primary winding and the secondary winding are on top of each other in the same magnetic core, and those two windings have an extremely close magnetic coupling. Every change in magnetic field of the primary will be respected, will be represented by an extremely close characteristic change in the voltage developed in the secondary winding. In the case of a Tesla coil, you've got a different kind of criteria here. In most Tesla coils, you're applying a pulsating direct current or a pulsating alternating current to the primary. You're doing it in spikes of usually a spark gap circuit. So you're putting in a pulse of energy, hopefully a lot of energy in watts or joules, and then when the pulse of energy you put into the primary ceases, the energy that's coupled from the primary to the secondary is coupled in a rather loose manner because there's a big air gap there. The secondary winding looks like the secondary of a transformer when you see it on a schematic diagram. In reality, it is a tuned LC circuit. It's got a tremendous number of turns that are giving it inductance. Let me drop. And although your eye may not see it at first, if you don't know how to look at it, it's got a tremendous amount of distributed capacitance. One end of the winding at the bottom is essentially grounded to earth. The upper ending at the top has got this donut-shaped metallic object, which is the upper terminal where the sparks jump out of. That represents a kind of top hat capacitor. So the secondary winding is a resonator with a very specific resonating frequency. And so you put pulses of energy into the primary of DC voltage, which makes the secondary winding ring down in a very characteristic shape when you view it on the right kind of an oscilloscope. You'll see a very sharp rising spike when the energy from the primary starts or stops. The secondary winding starts off with that spike, which might be, let me pick a number, a plus 10,000 volt spike on the secondary winding, 10,000 volt positive spike, and a microsecond later it swishes down to a minus 10,000 volt voltage and then oscillates between the two, between plus 10,000 and minus 10,000 in my example, and slowly rings down thousands of cycles later, and the amplitude becomes smaller and smaller for that particular pulse of energy that came into the primary by your spark gap generator. The very next spark gap, 16 milliseconds later, if you're feeding it with 60 cycle line, starts the process all over again. So it's a whole bunch of sequences of ringing down, and it's able to do that because the coupling between the primary and the secondary is an extremely loose air core coupling. The energy gets coupled through, but the voltage waveform on the primary and the voltage waveform on the secondary do not track as repeat.
timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
They do not track as closely as they would in an ordinary transformer. So making the measurements of a Tesla coil, and by the way, if you go to Google, among other search engines, and you simply type in the word Tesla coil and variations of it, you will get thousands and thousands of hits. You will find plans for construction. You'll find hardware that's being sold. You'll see YouTube movies of people who have built really big Tesla coils. The biggest one I know of is the guy in Oklahoma, where he's using a extremely big pole pig transformer as a step up for just the voltage into the primary, and he's putting probably tens and if not 50 kilowatts of primary power into that spark gap of his particular Tesla coil. His Tesla coil, as I remember, it looks to me like the thing is around 10 foot tall, and it makes spark gaps of around 10 feet in length. This thing is really dangerous. He's got a great big fence around it, which he closes before he turns the darn thing on. And so there are Tesla coils, and there are Tesla coils. Let me drop. So when it comes to evaluating your particular Tesla coil and ways of tuning it up, there's all kinds of ways of setting up the right kind of a network for the spark gap and the inductive kickback and whatever on the primary circuit, having the right kind of way of winding the primary. Sometimes the winding of the primary in the very high power ones, they start off with half-inch diameter copper tubing, which they wind into a flat pancake helical coil, and then the secondary winding is on some kind of a great big piece of PVC tubing wound with thousands and thousands of turns of fine wire, very closely wound and shellacked and held down. That's the secondary winding, as a great big pole, like a vertical radiator, sitting out of the center of that copper coil, which is the primary. And to evaluate how well that Tesla coil is working, I'm not convinced that a vector network analyzer is the right tool for evaluating that particular machine. An oscilloscope will tell you what the waveform looks like, and there are various ways, by spark gaps in oscilloscope readings, you can find out what is the peak voltage, what is the frequency of the ring down, what is the time constant of the ring down. These are the parameters the average person wants to know about with his Tesla coil. I know we're a little bit off to one side, but I think this is some of the information you're looking for. I'm going to pass it back to you for further evidence of your question, Wesley. Then we'll go over to Howie to find out what he was asking. N2XJN, the man who asked the original question, K2RIW on the TechNet.
This is November to X-ray Juliet November. The spirit of ham radio operation. Thank you, Dick, for all of the explanation. I was trying to direct you to exactly the area that I was interested with, and you actually gave the beautiful answer for that. But the spirit of ham radio operation does not allow to use the wording Wesley, shut up. Now, guys, if you don't like me here, that would be my last present in the TechNet and last present on this repeater. I'm waiting for the call sign of the gentleman who said, Wesley, shut up. He has had the courage to, we are this way, maybe he has the courage right now to give his call sign and to answer you.
Can I make my comments, please, Dick?
Wesley, when you have a repeater that covers as much real estate as this one does, northeastern New Jersey, southern New York State, and Connecticut's southwestern corner, where there's a large number of potential listeners, there's always going to be a certain percentage of people that are unhappy, that they feel that they don't have enough control of what's taking place. There's always going to be an extremely small percentage of people that are unhappy, and they make adverse comments. The philosophy of this repeater, as well as many other fairly intelligent repeater groups, is to thoroughly ignore the derogatory comments. If you give the derogatory comment person evidence that you've heard him and you address him, then he is getting the recognition he desires, and he will keep doing it. We ignore those. We accept them. The fact that it's a part of human nature. It's always going to take place. Don't take it personal. Just simply go on as if you didn't hear it. Howie, go right ahead with your question. K2LIW in the TechNet.
Comment.
It wasn't a question, it was a comment. When you're using vector network analyzers or site masters, you can use a cable. It's usually, I think it's color blue. It's an armored cable. It's a phase cable. It means it doesn't change phase. It's almost a perfect transmission line. It's very expensive, like a 3 or 4 foot jump will run you like $300 or $400 for that cable, Dick. You know what I'm talking about. It has no phase. If you bend it or move it around, it won't give you a phase situation. Go ahead, Dick.
There's a yes and a no to that one, Howie. Yes, you can buy some extremely high quality armored cable that when you bend it, its characteristics does not change, and it's a very rugged cable. If you're willing to not spend that much money on a very, very expensive cable, maybe at a flea market you picked up a good working vector network analyzer, and you've got nothing in your house except a radio piece of RG58 cable, you can make extremely good measurements with your radio piece of RG58 cable. You can calibrate at the end of your cable with all of its characteristics will be removed, and yes, during the measurement, you're not going to be heating up the cable, you're not going to be stretching it, and you're not going to be doing sharp bends with it, which might change its characteristics. And you can find out real fast if the characteristics of your particular cable change when you flex it, heat it, stretch it, whatever, by looking at the display of your particular piece of cable during the time there is a known good 50 ohm termination at the end of the cable. When you finish that calibration procedure, you put the termination on the end of the cable. You look at the vector network analyzer polar plot or Smith chart plot while you flex the cable. You'll very rapidly find out what deviation, what errors it's creating. And as you flex your particular radio piece of 58, RG58 cable at your particular frequency range, which is maybe 144 to 148 megacycles, you may find out that the phase shifts by 5 degrees and the amplitude shifts by 0.01 dB. My point is that under those particular circumstances, that amount of error is known by you ahead of time. It's very small compared to what you're trying to measure, and it's a relatively minor characteristic. So don't be scared into thinking you've got to buy a $2,000 piece of cable in order to make a vector network analyzer measurement.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Well, that's what they use in labs. That's what they use with SiteMasters.
Oh, yeah. The company that sells you SiteMaster tells you that the machine is going to explode, the warranty is going to be void, and all kinds of bad things are happening if you don't buy their $2,000 piece of cable. I think you see what's going on here. If you're trying to make a measurement to the nearest 0.01 degrees in phase and 0.001 decibels in amplitude, and you want your measurement traceable to the Bureau of Standards, yes, you need that $5,000 or $2,000 piece of cable. The majority of us don't need anywhere near that accuracy. When I use my calipers and I measure the length of a particular piece of semi-rigid cable and I measure to the nearest thousandth of an inch for the measurements for the circuit that I'm constructing, that's more than good enough. Don't be scared by that. And by the way, if you're using a ratty piece of cable and you want to now know how much error it's creating, the calibration procedure will tell that to you. And during the experiments, when you're flexing that piece of cable, you'll rapidly find out, hey, it creates 5 degrees of error if I do this, and if I don't do that, I only get 1 degree of error, and that's more than good enough. 90 degrees of phase shift when you're making a measurement, yes, that's a big deal. 1 degree of phase shift is nothing. You gotta be realistic here, and from my point of view. So don't let them scare you, Howie. They're trying to sell you expensive stuff. Sometimes you don't have to do that. There was one other person who said he wanted to make a comment. Start off with your call letters and your name, and go ahead with your comment. K2RIW on the TechNet.
Good evening, Dick. This is John, KC2WGV. I just wanted to make a little comment for Wesley. Interesting people like Wesley belong on this net, and it is important that he does not disappear from this type of discussion. That's all I wanted to say. If somebody can't wait in line for their turn or they're getting impatient, that's just too bad. Let them go somewhere else.
Well done, John. So, Wesley, don't let the fact that there's 0.1% people out there that are unhappy, that they don't have enough control of their particular life and this particular repeater, and they don't have enough control of K2KEY, they don't have enough control of K2RIW, and they don't have enough control of N2XJN, and maybe even John and Howie. Don't let that upset you. You're always going to get a small percentage of people that are unhappy. That's a given when you have an audience as big as this. So please ignore them in the future. Don't even mention the fact that you've heard them, because you're giving them recognition they do not deserve.
I want to make a small comment, if you let me.
Yeah, go ahead, but I don't think we have to say much more on this particular one. Go ahead, Howie. Wesley.
The thing is that some people have a problem with vision, some people have a problem with hearing, and some people have a problem with proper expression in English. Thanks to the beautiful group of people from the particular repeater and the particular club that I don't belong to, but I very much appreciate. And 200 people, they gather together just to help others and create a great society. Let me wrap. I should be treated as a handicap in the area of my ability to express myself properly in English. Simple like that. Somebody cannot walk straight, and you've got to accept it. But don't discourage people. Don't make a joke of these people and tell them, oh, you are crooked. Okay, so what? I am crooked. I'm trying the best that I can. Thank you very much, and Dick, back to you.
So as we're all finding out, there is various kinds of idiosyncrasies on a vector network analyzer, scalar network analyzer, spectrum analyzer, dynamic signal analyzer. These are all closely aligned machines in that each one of them generally has a display where the horizontal axis is frequency and the vertical axis is usually some kind of amplitude. Whether that amplitude be displayed as a signal amplitude in voltage or signal amplitude in decibels, signal amplitude in standing wave ratio or reflection coefficient, sometimes called S11, you can set up the machine for whatever is your favorite kind of display, and the machine will sweep in frequency. You tell it what the start frequency is, what the stop frequency is. They all have a significant learning curve. I worked for a division of Airborne Instruments Laboratory that developed a particular spectrum analyzer, and I was there during the development of it. And the learning curve to really find out all the things that a spectrum analyzer can do for you takes a considerable length of time. There's a man from Tektronix, I can't think of his name right now, Engelson, I think his name is, who wrote a book on how to get the best performance out of your spectrum analyzer. When you're using a spectrum analyzer, it is very easy to set the resolution bandwidth too narrow or too broad, set the sweep rate too fast, set the amplitude so that it's too strong or too weak by way of the RF attenuator or the IF attenuator knob that's usually on the front panel, although on modern instruments it's now a menu somewhere. So to properly set all the controls so that the display you get is the truth and it's useful, there's a significant learning curve. Nobody can walk up to a spectrum analyzer and say, yeah, all I've got to do is press go and connect my circuit to the front panel. There's a lot more to it than that. There's a significant learning curve. When you first got your transceiver that went from 80 to 10 meters, to learn how to align it, to learn how to set it to the right frequency, to learn how to set it to the right mode of operation, upper sideband, lower sideband, CW, FM, AM, whatever. There's a whole learning curve on every one of these instruments. There's a whole lot of knobs on the front panel, or the equivalent of knobs in the display device. Don't be frustrated by that. Accept that ahead of time, that you're going to be going to a class learning how to use it. I've used vector network analyzers and spectrum analyzers for a lot of years. I've learned many of the tricks, but I'm learning every day. And I was about to tell you about the most useful one in the world to a ham radio operator from my point of view. Let me drop. We amateurs in the early days used to build our own transmitters and build our own receivers. in, let's say, 1940 and 1950, that was a very popular way to get on the band. Nowadays, a good transceiver, let's say, for instance, for 80 through 10 meters, has got the equivalent of 1,000 transistors in there. You're not going to build that. You can buy it with a couple of weeks' salary, and after you buy it, if you bought a good brand that's got a good track record, if you decide you don't like it and you want to sell it a year later, you might be able to get 75 or 80% of your money back. So buying a piece of good, respected test equipment or buying a piece of transceiver is the right thing to do. When it comes to the antennas, now you're at a 50-50 point. You can decide you're going to build your antenna or you're going to buy your own antenna. If you decide to build and tinker with your own antenna, particularly on VHF, UHF frequencies and above, and if you manage to get a hold of a vector network analyzer that has the capability of a dual display, where it's got two separate colors, it's got a red curve and a yellow curve, for instance, is the way I normally set it up, and I set up a vector network analyzer such that the signal gain from input connector to output connector is represented as a blue line, and the yellow line is the standing wave ratio amplitude being simultaneously displayed. I set up the display so that the red curve, the blue curve and the yellow curve are on the XY plot at the same time. Now when I'm tinkering with an antenna in the antenna testing laboratory at the place where I normally work at, I can take a small tuning tool, which happens to be a long wooden stick with a piece of copper on the end of it, and I hold it near the driven element, or near the first director, or near the reflector. And if I...
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
If I hold that piece of copper tape, which maybe is a 1 square inch piece of copper tape on the end of a long wooden stick, if I hold it near the tip of any one of those Yagi elements, reflector, driven element, or director, I'm adding capacitance to the end of the element, and electronically, the element is being tuned to a lower frequency. Correspondingly, if I use a slightly larger piece of copper on the end of a tuning tool and hold it near the center of any one of those three elements, the larger piece of copper is creating a magnetic shunt which raises the frequency of that element. So by using a tuning tool near the center of an element or the tuning tool near the tip of an element, I can electronically make each individual element go up or down in tuned frequency. Then by way of the dual display, the blue curve is gain. If the blue curve went up representing more gain, I say, hey, that's good, I'm going to do more than that. Or if the blue curve goes down, I know the gain decreased, and I'm going to do less of that. So immediately I can find out whether or not a particular element, to maximize the gain, wants to be longer or shorter electronically by just watching the display in real time while I'm holding that tuning tool there. Simultaneously, let me drop. When I'm looking at the yellow curve, which is standing wave ratio, I can find out what is the impedance match of that particular element, the driven element, doing. And if I can simultaneously tune the antenna just right so that the blue curve representing gain goes up, the yellow curve representing standing wave ratio goes down, and I make them happen simultaneously, and because those are interacting tuning procedures, tuning one better might make the other worse in some cases, but if you're real lucky, both go in the right direction at the right time. You get a tremendous amount of information. I can take what normally would have been a week's worth of work, and I can boil it down to 10 minutes by looking at the display, by waving those tuning tools near the antenna. A vector network analyzer with a dual display can do that for you. It can save you a tremendous amount of time. It is hugely better than doing computer modeling. Let me explain that one. In the case of computer modeling, if you computer modeling some kind of very conventional antenna, skinny diameter elements of a three-element Yagi, and you tell it what is the spacing of the elements, the diameter of the elements, and the length of the elements, and you press go on that computer program, and you wait a couple of minutes, you get an answer. You get a reasonably good answer. But if you're building something more exotic, a large number of elements, very fat diameter elements, which have got a huge advantage when you do that, The modeling programs break down, they give you answers that are not accurate, and they take a long time. By doing it with real-time vector network analyzer and tuning tools, I can get an answer in a couple of minutes as to the right way to tune the antenna. By way of computer modeling, I get an answer that's not as accurate, and it takes many hours for each individual experiment of changing the length or the diameter or the position. So there are places where computer modeling works very well. There are places where empirical testing of an antenna works a hell of a lot better. That second procedure of testing antennas by really putting tuning tools near the antenna has caused me to put my name on quite a significant number of patent applications for brand new antennas that are being used in a particular application, a VHF, UHF application. So there may be 5,000 types of antennas out there. I and a few other people who like antenna tuning are trying to add to that number. So maybe this helps somewhat of giving you a little bit of a feel for what a vector network analyzer and a spectrum analyzer can do. I better go on to the next questioner, Wesley, and with the time left over, we'll come back. In fact, right now, to make sure we haven't lost the people that are have to go to bed early, we ought to go over to Mel and find out what his mail is like. K2KEY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Hey, this is K2KEY. I really didn't have a chance to really check it up to date, except for a number of comments I'll make, basically. Got a lot of positive feedback on the discussion that we did for a couple of weeks on that vertical and the unique ideas that we sort of thrashed out, how you can go about homebrewing the vertical if you would like to, you know, give a try as to what the characteristics of one of those monopole verticals are. Behind today, over.
Hey, you gotta be careful with that push button. Sometimes it becomes a little bit intermittent. I was gonna try real hard to go in to see you guys. There's three to four groups on the field day sites that I like to visit each year, and a bunch of complicated things happened at home. I got a late start, and I only managed to go to a couple of the field day sites. I didn't get a chance to go to the Kings County Radio Club site. Give us a little bit of a rundown of what was field day like for you, Mel, and your particular group. With your new, with your temporary new location, hopefully you had some good creature comforts and a good position to send out some strong signals, and people got some good enjoyment for 24 hours of continuous operation if they were so motivated. K2KEY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, this is K2KEY. Yeah, I better hold the mic. I usually grab the mic sometimes sort of upside down, and you don't get the grip on the butt. All right, well, as far as field days go, we've had worse, we've had better. The place that we basically have been sort of moved to because of the renovation of the Ryan Visitor Center that's been in progress now for the last couple of years, I gotta say, I don't know when it's going to be completed, but meantime we're in another building, and it did give us some antenna problems because we have to share that building with another communication system called what is known as City One, which is a backup system for emergency communication. So they sort of taken over most of our antenna positions, Dick, over.
So I think you're saying you had to put up compromised antennas in less than ideal locations. In other words, of course, the highest part of the building was taken over by the other service, and so you had to put up slopers and things that are off the side of the building and running from the building to the ground. Is that approximately what happened, Mel? Go ahead.
Well, what I did basically is we managed to have a support set near the roof, not too bad about it, maybe only about a foot or so below the roof at the conduit that is braced to the wall there, and I was able to fish a rope behind it and be able to use that as a pull-up point for dipoles. Wound up with using five separate dipoles, 10 through 80 meters, and basically try to keep them up as high as possible, the number of trees that are around. But, like you say, you know, sometimes you just got to improvise, and I did a lot of improvising this year. Overall, however, we had a nice time. Not too bad as far as a little on the warm side. You haven't got air conditioning, anything like that, but we did have some small fans, some floor fans and things of that sort. That made it bearable. And, well, what can you do? I guess there are people that will have to rough it a lot more than this thing's over.
Yeah, we consider the field day operation one of the high holy days of ham radio, where people get together and do sort of camping out in the field and staying out till late hours and sending war stories back and forth to each other and doing some serious operating. The whole intent was really a practice for emergency communication situations. So creature comforts not being the best sometimes is almost realistic. Guarantee under a real emergency situation, you're not going to always have the creature comforts you would like. But you'd certainly like to have portable equipment that can operate independently of normal power lines. A little bit later, I'm going to be asking people what was their field day like. But let's go to the questions so we don't keep people up too late. Paul, I think, was the next person with a question, WS2N. Paul, go right ahead if you're still there. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, Dick. This is WS2N. Yeah, I went to a couple of field days sites myself. And looking up at both sites I went to, Great South Bay, I visited them. And, of course, I went to Weimar. And I'm looking at these beams, and most of the beams I'm looking at are tri-band beams. And I'm looking at the traps on the tri-band beams. And I didn't think about this until I got home. You look at the traps down, you know, you off one side of the beam, you have, you know, you've got your director and reflector, and of course the dipole part in the middle. And each one has a trap, and then the other side of the beam has a trap as well. And I'm thinking about these things as tri-band beams. I remember with the dipoles, you know, when you want to operate like three bands, you know, they'll set up like two traps on each side of the dipole. You'll see one trap, another trap, and on the other side of the dipole, you'll see two more traps. And you'll run three different bands. You know, of course, you know, some of them might be resonant harmonics of different bands as well, but, you know, generally you get the three bands, you know, from one dipole with two traps on each side. Let me drop it. Looking at the tri-band beams, you know, I'm thinking to myself, well, if there's only one trap on each side, I mean, why isn't just two bands? I mean, how do they get the three bands out of that one? And by the way, the Weimar was very nice setup. Wow. Very, very good. I love all their ladders that they have straight up in the air with the antennas on top. It's pretty cool. Back to you there, Dick. This is WS2N.
Yes, I also visited the Limark site in almost Levittown. I'm not quite sure of the town that they're in at that government site. And just the way they use those aluminum expandable ladders with the webbing as the nylon webbing as the lower sets of guys and nylon rope as the upper sets of guys with an inner and outer set of stakes. Very safe looking operation with a nice fancy bracket they've got on the top two rungs of the ladder, which grabs onto those two rungs with sort of an L bracket where the mast for the Yagi and its rotator get attached. It looks like a rather nice arrangement. What you're really asking now is, where does this tri-band come from? Let me drop it. Let me first talk about a driven element. Let me just talk about a dipole. You could make a dipole that works very well on three frequencies by making the dipole with an inner set of traps and an outer set of traps. if, for instance, I wanted the dipole to operate on 10, 15, and 20 meters, I could have a dipole that's approximately the right length for 10 meters, which ends in a trap which represents an open circuit, an LC resonator on the left and the right side, which represents an open circuit for 10 meters. And therefore, the signal flows from the center of the dipole along the 10-meter dipole, hits those traps, and goes no further. Then when I want to operate on 15 meters, that trap is no longer tuned to that particular frequency, so now the signal flows through the 10-meter dipole through that trap, because the trap is now being used at a lower frequency than it was designed for. It is a slight inductance left over, as opposed to an open circuit. So the next section of the dipole resonates at 15 meters, and the next set of traps on the outer section of the dipole represent an open circuit at 15 meters. And then when you want to operate on 20 meters, the signal flows through the 10-meter section of the dipole, through the first trap, gets a little bit of inductance left over, through the 15-meter section of the dipole, through the trap on 15 meters, which is now at 20 meters, a little bit of inductance left over, and now it flows through the whole antenna, and those two sets of traps look like loading coils that make the 20-meter dipole a little bit shorter than it normally would be. That's one of a number of ways of making a dipole be the right electrical length on all three of those frequencies. Let me drop. That's not the only way of doing it, but that's one particular way. It's been done quite a few times in the past. And once you learn how to do that with the driven element, with the dipole portion of a Yagi, to do something similar with the director and reflector is one possible way. It's not the only way. You could start off by saying, I'm going to make the driven element work on the three bands in the way that I just described. I'm then going to set up a number of directors that operate on 10 meters on the exact same boom at slightly different locations. I'm going to put some directors that work at 15 meters, and on the exact same boom, I'm going to put some directors that work at 20 meters. That's another approach. There's going to be some interaction of those directors that I just described, but for the most part, when you're operating on, say, for instance, 20 meters, the directors you've got on the boom that were tuned for 10 meters are so short, so far from resonant, they're 98% transparent. To a 20-meter signal, a director that's sort of a dipole for the right length, that's 10 meters, for 10 meters, is so short that it has almost no resonance, almost no effect. The signal, the 20-meter signal doesn't see it. You'd be amazed, even though physically your eye says, gee, those elements are very close to each other, electronically, because they're tuned to different frequencies, they have an extremely small amount of interaction. When I've given people recommendations of how closely you can stack, let me drop, that you can take a 10-meter beam, a 6-meter beam, a 2-meter beam, and a 432-meter beam, stack them on the same vertical mast at extremely close spacings, and they have essentially no interaction between them because they're tuned to different frequencies. A naive person would say, I'm going to calculate the effective capture area of each one of those antennas and space them far enough apart that none of those capture areas touch each other. In the case of multiple Yagis vertically stacked on a mast, if the Yagis are on the exact same frequency, that's the right thing to do. When the Yagis are on different frequencies, like my example, 10, 6, 2, and 432, each individual Yagi only performs for that particular frequency and essentially disappears on all other frequencies, even if those frequencies are harmonically related. That's a hard one to accept. But when you finally find out with experiments how close you can stack them before you get performance degradation, you'll be amazed. You thought you needed 10 foot of stacking between these two antennas, and you can really stack them 1.5 feet apart, and you get the exact same performance when they're on different frequencies. That's when you're stacking individual Yagis on a vertical mast. Well, when you're putting individual Yagi elements on the same boom of a single Yagi, let me drop. Again, certain combinations of frequencies, those directors don't see each other. That's the next level of development of that kind of an antenna. Now, when you go the next step beyond that, you recognize the fact that there is a small amount of intercoupling between the elements on certain frequencies. And now you put traps and top hat capacitors and whatever on those individual passive elements, those parasitic elements. The next level of sophistication is to recognize the interaction and use it in a favorable manner. There's an infinite number of ways you can tune a Yagi, and there's at least 5,000 kinds of antennas. And when you look at the Antenna Engineering Handbook, the latest version of the fourth edition, which has got something like 60 individual authors all writing there, one or two of those authors, or in some cases three authors, write a particular section of the book which is dedicated to just that kind of an antenna, a beverage antenna, a horn antenna, a parabolic antenna, a Yagi antenna, dipole antennas, low-frequency antennas, high-frequency antennas, polyrod antennas. There's a zillion kinds of antennas, and the guys who are really good at each one of those sections have dedicated a good fraction of a lifetime developing that particular skill, and they've written that particular chapter of the Antenna Engineering Handbook. The editor, Mr. Velakis, is just the editor of all of these other authors of all of these individual sections. So, antenna design, to reverse engineer somebody else's, let me drop. If somebody writes a really complicated computer program, and you look at the source code, and you reverse engineer it to try to find out what it's doing and how it does it, it's five times more difficult than writing the original computer program itself, if you were the author. By the same token, you look at a guy who has been designing tri-band Yagis for most of a lifetime, and he's learned a whole lot of tricks of how to use the interaction between the elements in a favorable manner. And now you look at that antenna and try to reverse engineer it and figure out what's going on. It's not easy. If you carefully measured the amount of inductance and capacitance that's in each one of those each one of those tuning coils that's in each one of those elements, you measure the diameter of the elements and the length of the elements, and you put it into the right kind of a computer modeling program. And then you tell the computer modeling program, draw for me the current waveform or the voltage waveform on all of those elements at 20 meters, and then do it at 15 meters, and then do it at 10 meters. You'll be able to find out what's going on, and I guarantee you'll have a couple of surprises. You'll say, wow, why in the world does that tuning mechanism that's in the middle of the 15-meter element, how come it's got that particular reaction when the antenna is being fed at 10 meters? And look at that. That gives you a better standing wave ratio at the driven element, and it gives you a little bit forward, better forward gain, and a little bit better front-to-back ratio. So, as you can see, Paul, I'm not saying it's easy to understand. We can go step by step through the procedures by which these antennas have come about. You're looking at the fourth generation of a tri-band Yagi when you look at that thing today. A lot of history went before. And if you would like to, in one step, and if I would like to, in one step, understand how that particular design is...
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
And if I try to understand how that particular design is operating today, it's not easy. Whether you reverse engineer that particular tri-band antenna or reverse engineer somebody's pretty elaborate computer program, they're probably equally as difficult. If you dig deeper, do some more reading, look at the various designs of so-called tri-band Yagis, and there's quite a few brand names out there. They have certain similarities and certain differences. And what's the best way to go? Which one gives you the best bang for the dollar, the least amount of wind load, the least amount of weight, the easiest to install, the longest longevity? There's a whole lot of variables, as you can tell. So it ain't easy. And if you think you're a little bit overwhelmed, but you don't quite understand it, Paul, you're in very good company. WS2N, K2RIW in the TechNet.
K2RIW comments.
Okay, Dick, very good. Yeah, by the way, I looked through the handbook, the ARRL handbook. I mean, I saw all kinds of antennas and, you know, everything from the dipoles to slopers to, you know, but they talk about monobands, but they really don't talk about the trap beams in the handbook.
2 QAQ with a comment. You're going to be right after Mel. Mel, I'll bet you you've done some fiddling with tri-band Yagis. I bet you you've built a couple of them. And I bet you you've seen some of these crazy interactions of the individual elements on individual frequencies. K2KEY, K2RIW in the tech band.
This is K2KEY. Yeah. Now, I was just going to ask you, when we say trap, let's clarify it. When we say we are using a trap, making a trap dipole, etc., are we considering a trap has to have L and C, Dick, first of all? Over.
I would say yes, 90-some-odd percent of the time, Mel. If I've got a driven element, for instance, that looks from the center out toward the first trap like it's a 10-meter dipole, 8 feet to the right, 8 feet to the left, because 16 feet long is approximately a dipole on 10 meters. And then, from that point on, physically, I've got a coil and capacitor in shunt with each other, with some kind of a center insulator, supporting the rest of the element that goes out beyond that point for 15 and 20 meter operation. And that L and that C in the first embodiment would be a conductor and an inductor and a capacitor in parallel with each other, tuned to 10 meters, tuned to roughly 28 megacycles. At 28 megacycles, a parallel LC becomes a nearly perfect open circuit only at that frequency. Therefore, the RF energy on 10 meters flows from your transmission line from the center of the 16-foot center section of the dipole. It flows down that 8 feet to the right and 8 feet to the left, hits that trap, which is a perfect open circuit at 28 megacycles, and the signal flows no further. And it reflects back and forth in that 10-meter section when you're on 10 meters, and that does the radiating on that band, gives you the impedance match, and so on. So, with rare exception, a trap is an LC in parallel. That's not the only way to do it, but that's one good way that's often done. If I go one step beyond that, I can recognize the fact that the rest of the element going beyond... I can recognize the fact that the rest of the element going beyond the 10-meter trap, when I'm on 10 meters, if any signal flows into it, it represents a stray inductance or a stray capacitance. And therefore, I might let a little bit of the signal flow beyond the 10-meter trap into the 15-meter section of the antenna. The 15-meter section of the antenna probably acts, maybe inductive. And therefore, I slightly change the value of the inductor and the capacitor of that 10-meter trap, and I let a little bit of the current flow into the 15-meter section. And now my half-wave dipole becomes a three-quarter-wave dipole, because I like the extra gain I get out of it when I'm 15 meters. So you can make some variations here if you're smart enough, but that's not the usual way it's done, in my opinion. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Exactly. That's why I'm going to say this, because I've opened up several of the, well, you want to call them traps. Let's take a driven element on any tri-band beam. They have a so-called trap coil, whatever you like to describe it, duster, one on each side of the boom. I opened it up. There is no capacitor in there at all, Dick. If I describe how they do it, and I've seen it, this repeated on a number of different brands, it is something unique. And I'd like to, in fact, I wonder how they come up with this method. Is it a hit miss? Is there a formula? As Paul said, you don't really see any written material on how do they do it. How do they make one of these tri-band beams, modern version, work? Because if you open the case up, you slip the cover off, you got something very unusual. Wiring in there, I can call it a wiring, but there is actually no physical capacitor, Dick, over.
Well, hold on now, Mel, go a little bit slower. Because I'm making a total element that's going to be in the vicinity of 30 feet long if I'm going down to 20 meters, and the first plus or minus 8 feet, the first 16-foot section is the 10-meter dipole, and I got a hell of a lot more element I want to hang beyond that point. The strongest way I can hang tubular elements beyond that point is to telescope them together. Okay? If the elements beyond the 10-meter, if the driven element, if the dipole-like tubing beyond the 10-meter element is telescoped into the 10-meter element, but it's not an aluminum-to-aluminum fit, if I've got a dielectric material between the two that I'm telescoping, I've got a beautiful tubular capacitor that's part of the support mechanism that the eye doesn't see at first. So one of the ways of making the structure mechanically strong is by telescoping with a dielectric insulating material between the smaller diameter element that goes beyond the trap and the larger diameter element, which is the tip of the 10-meter dipole. So that telescoping area could be a beautiful tubular capacitor, which is a kind of distributed capacitor, a little bit like a stub, but it's a linear or collinear stub. So did you see any evidence of telescoping that could give you a center capacitor? K2KEY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Well, not exactly. That's why I brought it up. Now, let me describe what it looks like when you take one of those covers off. It's usually, aluminum outer cover. You slip it off. Inside there is a rod, a piece of insulating material. I think they use this white thing pretty strong. I think it may be, who knows, maybe Lexan even. And on it, there's two coils wound. Well, in fact, I'll describe it. If you were to make this on a piece of paper, make two coils next to each other, sort of in series, but they're not connected to each other. Now what happens is the rod coming from, let's say, the center of the boom goes into this tubular insulator and picks up the inner side of the coil. Another rod comes in the other side and picks up the inner side of the other coil. Now when the cover is slipped on, it picks up, it shorts, it makes a connection between the outside of the first coil to the outside of the other coil. That's what they look like, Dick. That's it. It's just two coils in there. One time I had it open to figure out if I could dip out the coils and actually figure out what the heck that is, the inductance is over.
Once you make yourself a three-dimensional, a cutaway diagram on a piece of paper, do you see any evidence of stray capacitance that could be across any of those coils? Mel, go ahead.
Not at all. All you do is see these two coils, like I say, sitting there on this rod, not connected to each other when it's open. In other words, what happens is, like I say, the rod comes in from one end, picks up the, if like you say, have two coils next to each other but not connected, where the two pieces come together, next to each other, the coils, that one rod picks up that point, they got a screw that goes into that rod. The rod going out to the outside there and all, next to that picks up with a screw going through. But when you put the cover on, it connects the outer limits of both coils together with a screw. That's what the cover does, that metal cover. Unless that metal cover is considered some kind of a capacitance, stick over.
The metal cover being in the vicinity of the coils is definitely a distributed capacitance. The next question I've got, when it's all put together, do you believe the two coils that you're describing are being used in series or in parallel? It almost doesn't matter. The cover itself is near the turns of the coil, adding distributed capacitance. And depending on how I design the antenna, it doesn't have to be a perfect trap at exactly 28 megacycles. It could be using the rest of the element beyond the 10-meter trap, which is acting as a series inductor. No, let me think. A capacitor. Not sure which. Anyhow, the reactance of the rest of the element combined with the coil makes the amount of trapping action that they desire. And maybe the trap is not tuned to 28 megs. It may be tuned to some other frequency because they're intentionally setting up a resonance on that dipole that's not exactly half-wave long. I'll bet you, Glenn, you've looked at some of these traps, and maybe you've figured out some of them. KC2QIQ, have you done some reverse engineering of these tri-banders? K2RIW and the TechNet.
Yeah, not so much with the tri-banders, but I believe what Mel is getting at is that they are pretty much dominant L. What really happens there is that, you know, when you start looking at quarter wavelengths of antennas, or multiples of quarter wavelengths, what will happen is, you have voltage maximums and minimums along that length. And then if you put an L, a large L, at the end of that quarter wavelength, it has a very minor tuning effect on the quarter or half wavelength, if you know what I'm saying. And then it just looks like a high impedance because it's just an L sitting on the end. Maybe it looks like maybe almost like a little capacitance hat sticking off the end. But because the inductance is at the end of a quarter wavelength or a half wavelength, the impedance is so radically different that L is just enough to trap it off. And as far as any kind of resonance, I would hope that the trap is like way out of the way of any resonances. Probably because it would just over dissipate in heat. I don't know if that makes any sense, Dick. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Maybe yes or maybe no. In the case of the resonance of, say, for instance, a parallel kilowatt amplifier, where the resonator is a very wide strip of copper with a flapper capacitor for tuning, something like 20 or 30 kilowatts is flowing back and forth in that box of resonant energy, and you're drawing out 700 watts on each pass. So resonator and loss doesn't necessarily go together. Yes, resonator does mean it's got some finite Q. Q does mean if it's got a Q of 10, that means there is a voltage rise of 10 to 1 or a current rise of 10 to 1 somewhere in the structure. That's one of the four or five definitions of Q. But if you've used the right materials, the extra voltage or the extra current doesn't necessarily have to be a substantial amount of loss. Now, if you bought a tri-band Yagi that's rated for 150 watts maximum, and you put key down energy in there of 1,500 watts, and you're running a high duty factor like a radio teletype or something like that, you're probably going to burn something up, depending on how much conservativeness there was in the design. So you got to be a little bit careful along those lines, But resonance doesn't necessarily mean loss. It could if you've used marginal materials for that particular application. Let me drop. It is possible to make traps and put them in the right place where they're nothing more than a pure or a nearly pure inductance. And Mel seems to be suggesting that's what he saw when he disassembled those particular traps. You can come up with an antenna design with nothing but inductance. And maybe the amount of capacitance there is a small amount of stray capacitance. I wonder if you know of a website, Mel, where there is a diagram. I'll bet you there isn't. Now, quite possibly the manufacturer considers that design proprietary. He holds it close to his chest, unless some particular amateur has decided to disassemble it and photograph it and put it on a website, there may not be a breakdown. I wonder, but still there may be. There are amateurs who like home brewing popular antenna designs. So there may have been somebody who did a breakdown and photograph. I wonder if you know of one of those, Mel, where I can actually see a picture of what you're describing, because it sounds kind of interesting. K2KEY, K2RIW on the TechNet.
Exactly. That's what I try to find. A number of these make antennas, like you say, it's proprietary, to the point where, no, you do not see anything. I have never seen anybody try to do any kind of reverse engineering or explain. And I was very curious because there's a couple of very good antennas, of which one I own. And I happened to be able to get a hold of the one that was slightly wrecked. And so I took the so-called traps, you want to call them? I don't know. I don't know how to even describe them. I said to myself, how would I go about if I wanted to make, say, oh, I don't want to make it. I wanted to operate on, say, 20 meters and, say, 30 meters. Not 10 and 15, 20. I want to do some changing around. I want to take this antenna and use it. How do I go about? What am I looking at? In other words, I can't just randomly try to keep winding coils or whatever and trying and put this whole thing together and then say, let's see, the